My only role this morning is to bring to the podium a good friend of the Federalist Society who is going to be introducing our speaker today, Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina. Alan Gauthier is someone I've known for a number of years. He's, as I said, a very good friend of the Society. He's the managing director of ETC Capital in Michigan, and he's quite well qualified to introduce our speaker because he has known Governor Haley for a number of years. So with that, I will bring the, give the podium to Mr. Gauthier. Alan.
Thank you, Leonard. Well, when it comes to judging leadership, in my humble opinion, there are only two things that matter: results and kindness. And it is my distinct pleasure today to introduce someone to you who has an abundance of both. She's ruled with a very steady hand under very difficult circumstances, but has done so with heart and soul in mind. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Governor Nikki Haley. Governor?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It is absolutely great to be here. I first want to, I had a great chance chatting with Leonard, and I want to congratulate him wherever he went on being with the Federalist Society for 25 years. That's pretty amazing, and I think everybody owes him a round of applause. I also want to thank Alan and Carrie Gauthier. They have been dear friends and just very great supporters. And if you ever really want to have a good conservative sparring fight and not feel like you're the only lone soul, Alan's your guy. So he's fantastic to work with. So thank you for having me. And I want to start by saying hyperbole is something that has become all too common in the world of politics. That's not a particularly bold statement. We all follow the news. We all know that it's true. And we all know if it can have a poisonous effect on our political system and on our society at large. I say that to say this: exaggeration is something I try to avoid at all costs. So keeping that in mind, we are currently living through what may be the most interesting time in American political history. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about it today. Where we are, how we got here, where we're going. These are all questions being asked around the nation and, frankly, around the world. There is no single answer, but a theme you will hear from me consistently, today and going forward, is the need for honesty. In an effort to practice what I preach, I have to admit that I'm a little, or maybe a lot, intimidated to be here. I've turned down this invitation in the past, not because I don't have a tremendous respect for the Federalist Society, but because I'm not a lawyer. I'm an accountant by trade. Accountants believe interpretations come from facts through numbers. Those numbers tell a story. That story is meant to be used to create a better way of doing things. So the goal is to take the numbers that are fact, create a vision which creates more opportunity and more stability without causing harm. By implementing that vision, constantly checking its progress against real, meaningful benchmarks, we can create a better life. There is always a solution if we are creative enough to find it. That's my education. That's my life experience. It's what I know. My experience with attorneys didn't always line up with that. The lawyers in my life have seemed to have been taught to say no to everything. For a while, I was conventional, took a class in law school that simply was how to say no. So I can tell you that we've always had that issue in our office. I was never a fan of lawyers because I always felt like their instincts led them to stop everything, irrespective of whether it was positive or negative. But my opinion has evolved. First, I had no idea how much I would be sued as governor. So I So I have learned it's kind of nice to have you guys around. But second, and more seriously, as a governor, as the head of a branch of government that is supposedly constitutionally co-equal, I have come to truly respect the value of attorneys and judges who see, use, and interpret the law as it was intended. Because we all know that doesn't always happen. America, not just the Supreme Court, not just the legal community, but our nation as a whole, lost an icon this year with the passing of Justice Scalia. Putting aside the immediate effect his decisions had on American law, he inspired millions of Americans to think right about the law. And by right, I certainly don't mean in the political or socially acceptable sense, but as the word itself was intended to be used correctly. When I think about Justice Scalia, what I appreciate the most is that he never looked at the law or the Constitution through the eyes of a man who wanted to be a legislator. While his rhetorical skills and love of life make the word simple one that few who would use to describe the justice, his judicial philosophy strikes me as so significant precisely because of its simplicity. The Constitution is the Constitution. The law is the law. The outcome is the outcome. Legislatures make the laws, executives execute the laws, and judiciaries interpret the laws. Period. I have always seen the role of government through similar eyes. Government was intended to secure the rights and freedoms of the people. It was never intended to be all things to all people. Sadly, we've strayed away from that course in America today. Before we go down that path, I want to say this. While I won't pretend to have always been President-elect's biggest cheerleader, I did vote for him, and I was absolutely thrilled to see him win. There are absolutely so many opportunities in front of us because of his victory. At the forefront, the opportunity for President Trump is to ensure Justice Scalia's legacy of judicial restraint isn't just preserved, but it's expanded on the Supreme Court. President Trump will likely have the opportunity to shape the future of the court for a generation. And thanks in large part to the people in this room, America should be a much better, much more just nation because of it. This election brought with it countless things we never thought we'd see. There's no need to run through all of them here, other than to say that there are important lessons to outcomes, both in the primaries, Democrat and Republican, and in the general election. Lessons that we must acknowledge, honestly, and problems that we must fix. The after-the-fact dissection of a presidential candidate almost always focuses on the losing side. That's understandable. But if we as Republicans are going to lead effectively and have staying power as a governing party, we must accept that Donald Trump's election was not an affirmation of the way Republicans have conducted themselves. The president-elect deserves tremendous credit for the way he was able to connect with the electorate, but he did not do it by celebrating the Republican Party. And the American people did not vote for him because he had an R next to his name. He ran against both parties, against the political system at large, a system he argued was fundamentally broken. An argument that the voters subscribed to in massive numbers. They rejected the political class of all stripes, Republicans included, and we have no one to blame but ourselves. There have been broken promises at every level of government. We need to go back to the basics and remember that we are the party of limited government, the party committed to creating opportunities for all people, the party of inclusivity. We pulled away from that over the past decade, We saw a Republican Congress that kept levels of spending completely out of control. We saw Republican elected officials move to expand Medicaid instead of working to find real solutions to our health care problems. We saw Republicans start to move towards big government instead of away from it with things like Common Core. Republicans lost our way. We were told that if we elected a Republican House and a Republican Senate, everything would change. Millions of people worked hard to give Republicans that chance, yet we never saw action. Spending continued to climb, health insurance premiums continued to go up, the federal government continued to make it harder to do business in America. We expected stacks of bills to be put on President Obama's desk so the public could truly understand where he wanted to take the country and where we did. That never happened. Instead, Republicans ignored the growing anger and frustration that was building among the American people. They were watching their paychecks shrink, their student loans grow, their daily lives become more difficult, and all they saw was Washington, D.C., with Republicans continuing to blame Democrats. About a year ago, I was given the opportunity to speak to the country following President Obama's State of the Union. I don't make a habit of quoting myself, but I want to repeat a part of the speech because I believe it is even more important today than it was in January. Quote, at the outset, I'll say this. You've paid attention to what's been happening in Washington in recent times, and you're not naive. Neither am I. I see what you see, and many of your frustrations are my frustrations. A frustration with a government that has grown day after day, year after year, yet never serves us any better. A frustration with the same endless conversations we hear over and over again. A frustration with promises made and not kept. We need to be honest with each other and with ourselves. While Democrats in Washington bear much responsibility for the problems facing America today, they do not bear it alone. There is more than enough blame to go around. We as Republicans need to own that truth. We need to recognize our contributions to the erosion of the public trust in America's elected leadership. We need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken, and then we need to fix it. That was what I said last January. Now, with a unified Republican government in Washington, with 34 Republican governors, more Republican-controlled state legislatures than ever before, we have the chance to do that. It's an exciting time in our history, a time to look in the mirror, remember who we are and what we believe in, a time to stop the talk and start the action. The opportunity is there. We now have a chance to work on meaningful solutions, to change the way we communicate, to remind people that the GOP is the party that will deliver freedom and possibility to all citizens, regardless of their race, gender, or where they were born and raised. That, after all, is what drew me to the Republican Party in the first place, and what drew my parents to America. I am the proud daughter of Indian immigrants who reminded my brothers, my sister, and me every day how blessed we were to live in this country. They left a wealthy lifestyle in India with just $8 in their pockets to come to America and start completely over. Why would they do that? Because even in 1969, they understood that no amount of money, no lifestyle, can compare with the opportunities we have in America. Only here can you be anything you want to be if you're willing to work hard for it. Only here do the circumstances of your birth not define your future. Only here is anything truly possible. That is the promise of America. That is the promise of my Republican Party. And that is the promise we've tried to deliver in South Carolina. When I took office in January of 2011, South Carolina was struggling. Like many other states, the Great Recession was hanging over us like a dark cloud. Jobs were scarce, economic anxiety was real, the American dream felt out of reach for way too many. Our state government was in shambles. We had short-term deficits and long-term debt. Our public schools were failing too many of our students. Faith in our system had bottomed out. It was daunting, the collection of challenges we faced. I remember not knowing quite where to start. And then I came across a quote from one of my favorite predecessors, Governor Carol Campbell, who used to say that if you can find a person a job, you can take care of a family. I've always believed in controlling what I can control. And while governors do not create jobs, there is a lot we can do. And that starts with taking care of the businesses we already have. We got to work. We cut business taxes. We passed tort reform that for the first time in our history capped damages on lawsuits. We invested in infrastructure without raising taxes. We stripped all of our regulatory boards and replaced the chairman of our largest and most bureaucratic permitting board with the president of a construction company. We knew that if you were costing a person or a business time, then you were costing them money, and that was no longer acceptable in the state of South Carolina. We cut our debt in half, and we doubled our reserves. Look at us now. We build planes with Boeing. We build cars with BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and now Volvo. We now have 5 international tire companies. First American flat-screen televisions? You'll find them in rural Winnsboro, South Carolina, with Element Electronics. And for those who said bicycles would never again be made in the United States, look no further than Kent International, a New Jersey bike manufacturer we brought back from China to rural Manning, South Carolina. They now refer to us, and I love this, as the Beast of the Southeast. More than 80,000 new jobs and $20 billion invested have been announced in South Carolina over the last 5 years in every single one of our 46 counties. We've moved almost 40,000 people from welfare to work. We've now started an inmate-to-work program, which allows us to team up with our inmates, match them up with the skills they need, and they are now able to leave the fence with a job and not just a bus ticket. Unemployment has been cut by more than half, from 11.1% in 2011 to 4.9% today. And more South Carolinians are working today than ever before in our state's history. And you have one of your members here that I have to thank for that, my Director of Employment and Workforce, Cheryl Stanton, if you would please stand. Rockstar, just saying. Over the last few years, I've been asked often about what has taken place in South Carolina, as if there's some secret formula that spurred our transformation from a state crushed by the collapse of the American Textile Companies to the fastest growing economy on the East Coast. My answer is that most things in government, it's not as complicated as it's made out to be. What we accomplished in South Carolina was not rocket science. It was always about common sense and about a willingness to get creative, challenge norms, and a belief that all things were possible. Look at education, for instance. South Carolina, we've lagged behind in education for a very long time. And yes, we're still behind, but we won't be for much longer. My first year in office, I received a letter from an 8th grade girl who was being bullied at school. She was contemplating suicide and didn't know where to turn. I'm grateful I got her letter. I was able to talk to this young lady, full of potential, and we struck up a friendship. but I realized she wasn't alone. And so I started going to schools and around the state talking about bullying. It was a wake-up call, but not for the reasons you might think. My daughter, Rena, recently graduated from a brand new public high school in Lexington, where every classroom has a flat-screen TV and every child has a tablet. It would be easy to mistake River Bluff High School for a small college. Yet when I went back to my hometown of rural Bamberg to give an anti-bullying speech, they didn't even have the equipment to play a video on. That's wrong. It's immoral. And it's changing. More than 4 years ago, I started a conversation about education in South Carolina. I met with principals and teachers, superintendents and university deans, business leaders and legislators, Republicans and Democrats. I listened, I learned, and I realized the biggest challenge facing South Carolina's education system was our failure to acknowledge that it simply costs more to educate a child who lives in poverty. We acknowledge it now. We changed our funding formula to send additional state dollars for children who are on Medicaid or free and reduced lunch. We now provide reading coaches for every elementary school in South Carolina, and we've ended social promotion. Because we know if a child cannot read by the end of the third grade, they are four times less likely to graduate from high school on time. We're investing in technology, internet to the schools, internet inside the schools, and the tools, computers, tablets, instructional materials, to get every South Carolina child up to speed with the world as it is today, not as it was three decades ago. We are now aggressively recruiting teachers to rural areas and challenging districts, and just as aggressively incentivizing teachers to stay there. We are doing all of this with accountability. We are doing all of this without raising taxes. And we are already seeing that work. We have made immense changes to the way we teach our kids in South Carolina, changes that will be as impactful as they are uncomplicated. And these changes are happening because of two very simple things, both of which are quite uncommon in politics today: a willingness to acknowledge a problem and a willingness to move outside of our comfort zones in order to find the solution. It was out of the ordinary for a Republican governor to go to the teachers and the principals and superintendents to talk about education reform. That was the Democrats' territory. And so it remained unexplored in a state dominated by Republicans. But those conversations helped me understand where they were coming from and how and why actions government took made things worse rather than making them better. And it helped them begin to trust me and my intentions, helped us build a relationship that in the end enabled us to together push these changes through our legislature. Everyone wants to feel heard. And in this nation, everyone deserves to be heard. For too long, leadership of both political parties has written off large groups of our fellow Americans. The angst, the unrest, the distrust of our institutions. These are all very real, very honest responses to a system that has not worked for so many different people in so many different ways. But just as our political leadership's willful ignorance of the public's desire for government, that at the very least attempts to serve them, has brought us to a time of distrust and stagnation, outreach and honest communication can have the opposite effect. It can lead to policy successes, as it did with education in my state, and it can lead to even more expansive, heartfelt change, as also happened in South Carolina just 18 months ago. I speak of the Mother Emanuel tragedy that happened in Charleston and the removal of the Confederate flag. When I first got word of the shootings, I knew this was going to be unbearably painful for our state. 9 shooting deaths in a church on a Wednesday night at Bible study. A state senator and a leading figure in the local black ministry shot to death. We've never imagined anything this horrifying. Each new piece of information was another kick in the gut. The next morning, we captured the killer, and it immediately became clear that this was the act of a racist, motivated not by mental illness, but by pure hate. Our state suffered a devastating wound. The first thing we needed to do was to lift up those families and celebrate the lives of the victims. I decided to attend each funeral. I met the families. I heard the stories. And through it all, I had the privilege of meeting 9 amazing souls. After each funeral, I would take the program with the person's picture on it to my 2 kids, Rena and Naylan, and I would introduce them to the person that I met that day. I introduced them to Ethel Lance, who, despite losing her daughter to cancer 2 years prior, was a woman of love and joy who constantly sang her favorite song, "One Day at a Time, Sweet Jesus, That's All I'm Asking of You. Give me the strength to do every day what I have to do." I introduced them to Tywanza Sanders, our youngest victim, a 26-year-old budding entrepreneur anxious to open his own barbershop, who on that night stood in front of his 87-year-old Aunt Susie and spoke his last words to the murderer: "You don't have to do this. We mean no harm to you." I introduced them to Cynthia Hurd, whose life motto was to be kinder than necessary. That is now my life motto. Every opportunity I have, I mention the 9 we lost and the 3 survivors, the Emmanuel 12. I don't want it to be just their families who know the love, the compassion, the greatness of those people. I want the whole world to know them, as my children do and as I do. The second thing that needed to happen was removing the Confederate flag from the State House grounds. There are many wonderful, decent, honorable people in our state who revere that flag. They are not racist. They are the same people who twice elected an African-American U.S. senator and twice elected an Indian-American governor. As I said when I announced my intention to bring down the flag, this was a debate that did not need to have winners and losers. Those who revere the flag for reasons of ancestry or heritage retain every right to do so. But what happened in Charleston shed a different light on an issue and a state that we had long struggled with. What we saw in the extraordinary reaction to Charleston was people of all races coming together. We didn't have riots. We had vigils. We didn't have protests. We had hugs. The State House belongs to all people, and it needed to be welcoming to all people. That was not possible with the flag flying. When it came to the removal debate, we had legislators who truly listened to each other. They walked in each other's shoes, and that made all the difference. That willingness to listen allowed all of us to see each other in a way that doesn't always happen, with love and grace and compassion. It's a love that we learned from the Emmanuel 12, who took in someone that fateful night who didn't look like them, didn't sound like them, didn't act like them. And instead of calling the cops, or instead of throwing him out, they pulled up a chair and they prayed with him for an hour. It's a grace we learned from their families, who incredibly stood in front of the murderer just 2 days later and offered him forgiveness. It's a compassion we learned from the people of South Carolina, who wrapped their arms around those families, that community, and each other in a way we've never seen before. The flag came down, and South Carolina has moved forward. Our nation has just been through an election as contentious as any most can remember. We are a deeply divided nation. Of that, there is no question. but I'm an optimist at heart. How can I not be? Blessed as I am to be a governor of a state that time and time again has pulled through tragedy stronger than when we started. This is the lesson I will take from my time in office, a lesson taught to me by the gracious, faithful people of South Carolina, a lesson that I will continue to share with people across this nation, that through our challenges, we find our strength. It is my hope that our newly unified government embraces our challenges and finds our strength. For if we do, if we listen to the will of the people, if we learn from mistakes of the past, if we embrace the opportunities of the future and govern with honesty and integrity, there is no limit to where the Republican government can take our nation. Thank you very much. God bless. I think we might have time to take a couple of questions. And Abby, you just cut me off when I need to.
Yes, Governor Haley, thank you so much for your leadership. There are a lot of people looking for you, looking to you for inspiration. And to the 34 Republican governors who now have a way of maybe taking power out of Washington, so my name is Roman Bueller. I was Newt Gingrich's first committee counsel 25 years ago. I'm with a group called the Madison Coalition. And my question is, most of the people in this room think that the last administration has usurped the Article I power of Congress and is rewriting laws through the regulatory process, and we'd like to end that. And there is a proposal out there called the Regulation Freedom Amendment, which has been endorsed by the Republican National Committee, is in the Republican platform, and 19 state legislative chambers around the country and six governors have urged Congress to propose it. It would require that Congress approve major new federal regulations and defines major as any regulation that is objected to by a quarter of the House or the Senate. The idea is that in the same way that states persuaded Congress to propose the Bill of Rights and more recently presidential term limits, that pressure from two-thirds of the states, including South Carolina and others, could persuade Congress to propose the amendment without having the risk of a constitutional convention. My question is, do you think that's the kind of approach that might work to start taking power out of Washington and curbing the administrative state?
Well, I don't know enough about what exactly you're talking about, but what I can tell you is in our conversations with, I did say I was an accountant, right? So what I can tell you is our focus is to, first of all, roll back as many regulations as possible, whether it's the overtime rule, whether it's the EPA, whether it's all those things. The importance of repealing Obamacare is extremely important, and I've heard it both from President-elect Trump as well as from Vice President-elect Mike Pence, so I know that's going to happen. What I can tell you that the governors have been talking about with the administration is it is extremely important now to move as much back to the states as we can. We see this as a huge opportunity, whether it's education, whether it's dealing with Medicaid, whether it's working on block grants. There are a lot of opportunities that we want to do that. And so what we have decided as the Republican Governors Association is that, first of all, Mike Pence, who was a congressman, was also a governor and loved being a governor, but he felt it firsthand, and he has offered to be our conduit to make sure that we get all of those things done. The second thing that I will tell you is that we are also going to be meeting with Speaker Ryan and leadership in the Senate to make sure that we're not just governors sitting back in those states. If we've got this whole slate, we are going back to the top to make sure that everything that has been done over the last 8 years and prior is rolled back so that we can now get more control in the states so that we can really take care of our people in the best way we know how.
Governor,
I know you.
For those who don't know me, I'm her attorney general. And
so either he's telling me to get off stage really quick.
I was actually going to make a joke because in the beginning of your remarks, you said that you weren't too sure or too warm to lawyers, and that kind of took me back. So I'm so happy to learn that you've become warm to us. I did want to say this publicly. I have never felt anything but warmth from you and your administration, and your commitment and your staff's commitment to the rule of law has been instrumental in our ability to be able to fight the rollbacks of the administration, their unlawful executive and regulatory overreaches. So I wanted to thank you for setting a model for the AG-governor relationship, which isn't always what it should be in other states, but in South Carolina, we are the beast of the East, you and I. I also wanted to state for you, Governor, I was speaking with my dear friend Ann Corkery outside right before you came in to give your speech, and we were talking about the Mother Emanuel massacre as well as the police shooting in North Charleston 3 months prior to that. And when you look around the country and you see the police officer-involved shootings that have a racial overtone to it, and you see the riots and you see the mayhem and the discord that goes on between the various communities in South Carolina, two tragedies happened within 3 months of one another. And in South Carolina, that didn't happen. And the reason that didn't happen is because of the tone of leadership that was set at the top and from our religious leaders, our African-American leaders, and the leadership in government, which started with you. And I wanted to publicly thank you for your support in that regard, too.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you. Okay, Abby's telling me one more question.
Governor,
so make it a good one.
I'll try, Governor. First of all, thank you for your speech. My name is Shane Finn. I represent the Disraeli Society at the University of Oxford, United Kingdom. And as well, thank you for your lovely hospitality in your country. It's great. I don't want to be a spoil sport, but I just have a question about going forward. So in the United Kingdom, with our campaign to leave the European Union, one thing we saw was that the pollsters got it completely wrong. Which worked for our side, and we saw similar things over here where the pollsters got it completely wrong in relation to the presidential election. Do you think there is a possibility that, you know, in politics you have the pendulum swings? While it worked for the Republicans this time around, do you think going forward there could be a potential that confidence can't be regained by the people in polling and in giving their opinions, and that it might be the case that potentially a problem could come, not maybe next year or the year after, but a few years down the line where the Republicans might not see it coming, that they have an issue similar to how the Democrats did? Or do you think that going forward, the Republicans can unify the people and bring back the confidence in polling, in giving your opinions, and in expressing what you think of the government?
So I think I understood your accent. And I appreciate it very much. Welcome. We're glad to have you here. You know what I think is the fact that the people spoke. They felt a frustration. They trusted their government. They trusted their elected officials. And nothing came of it. And we saw frustration like we've never seen before. And Republicans were as much to blame for that as Democrats. What happens from here, I think we have to seize an opportunity. And the opportunity is not waiting until the next election. The opportunity is that we need to see something in 30 days, in 60 days, in 90 days, in 120 days, and we don't stop, because that is what the American people have demanded. And I always side with the American people. I always side with the decisions that they make, and I always think it's up to us to make the opportunity out of those decisions. And so I am looking for it to be a bright day in America, and you will see everyone's very excited. We don't know exactly what President-elect Trump is planning as he goes forward, but we owe it to him to give him the support and the strength that he needs so that we can all work together to be successful. Thank you again very much. God bless.